Actu SF, les podcasts.
Alors je suis très ému, hein, donc j'espère que je ne vais pas dire trop de bêtises. Donc nous avons cette année l'immense chance d'avoir à nos côtés en invité Kim Stanley Robinson, mesdames et messieurs. On peut l'applaudir déjà avant même qu'il ait parlé. Alors sa présence est un travail de longue haleine mené par Jeanne Debatz, par Roland Lehoucq, par toute l'équipe des Utopiales, et on est vraiment, vraiment, vraiment très, très heureux. Alors on n'a qu'une heure. Il prend une photo. On a qu'une heure, on va avoir énormément de sujets à aborder avec lui. Pour préparer cette rencontre, Stan, j'ai tout de suite compris qu'on ne pouvait pas tout traiter. Évidemment, son œuvre est trop importante et qu'on n'arriverait pas à tout traiter. Donc j'ai essayé de proposer, et avec son accord, parce qu'on a, préparé cette rencontre, j'ai essayé de proposer avec son accord de concentrer sur deux mondes qui sont chers à son cœur. Deux mondes sur lesquels il a beaucoup travaillé, la Terre et Mars. Et c'est autour de ces deux pôles que l'on va travailler, parce que pour moi, Kim Stanley Robinson, au-delà de toute la diversité de son œuvre et de ses grandes thématiques et de son travail sur l'utopie, il nous a énormément donné sur la compréhension de la complexité même de la science-fiction, des enjeux écologiques, des enjeux sociétaux, des enjeux politiques, de la place de la délibération, de l'importance d'une société à se réinventer dans toutes les crises qu'elle peut traverser, et puis toujours bien sûr, de croire au futur. Et en fait, si j'ai choisi cette présentation, un auteur entre deux mondes, c'est parce que je me suis rendu compte, en relisant son œuvre, en préparant, qu'en réalité, eh bien, petit à petit, Mars, la Mars de Kim, la Mars de Stan, devient une terre pour nous, une terre alternative, une terre où tout est possible, et qu'à l'inverse, parfois, eh bien, notre terre, elle devient comme une Mars, en crise écologique, parfois en assèchement, en voie d'assèchement. Et c'est cette dualité entre ces deux mondes que j'ai voulu mettre en avant à travers cette rencontre, et dont nous allons évidemment, que nous allons partager avec vous tous. Alors, j'imagine que vous avez des tas de questions pour Kim Stanley Robinson. Ce qu'on va faire, c'est que j'ai prévu trois grandes étapes, et entre chacune de ces étapes, on donnera la parole au public pour avoir des questions liées à cette partie-là. En gros, on va partir de la Terre telle que nous la connaissons, de la Terre telle qu'il a vécue, telle qu'il a discutée, telle qu'il a mise en lumière et en avant. Puis on ira sur Mars et on finira sur l'utopie. Et dans ces trois étapes, eh bien, j'espère que vous aurez beaucoup de questions. Enfin, avant de commencer, je tiens à rendre hommage à l'excellent travail de Pascal Thomas, qui est un modérateur et un auteur connu et un participant connu des Utopiales, qui devrait être parmi nous si son train lui a permis d'arriver à l'heure, et qui a fait un formidable dossier Kim Stanley Robinson dans Bifrost, dans le numéro 106 de Bifrost, qui est un incontournable pour tous ceux qui se passionnent pour Kim Stanley Robinson. Allez, on y va, on commence. Alors, première chose, deux bouquins incontournables à mettre en avant dans son œuvre. Le ministère du futur, qui vient de sortir et qui est à la librairie, et puis Mars la Rouge, qui est le premier pas, en fait, les 100 premiers, Underhill, on va en parler, qui est le premier pas de sa trilogie. Alors, pour commencer par la Terre, puisque j'ai promis qu'on commencerait par la Terre, parlons d'abord, Stan, de la Californie, du rapport que tu as à tes racines californiennes, à tes origines californiennes. La Californie est bien souvent présente dans ton œuvre, elle est bien souvent évoquée, tu l'as vu se transformer, cette Californie, une Californie qui était très agricole et puis qui s'est industrialisée, une Californie qui a aussi été confrontée à des nécessités de se réinventer. Et cette Californie, pour moi, elle est l'un des deux pôles de ton identité, l'autre étant la Suisse, on en parlera peut-être tout à l'heure. Et la première chose que je voulais te demander, c'est aujourd'hui, ton rapport à la Californie, Comment il est ? Est-ce que tu écris encore autour de la Californie, au sujet de la Californie ? Est-ce que tu gardes au cœur cette Californie de ton enfance ? Et quelle a été l'influence de ton enfance en Californie sur l'ensemble de ton travail et notamment sur la thématique écologique de tes romans ?
Well, thank you for that. And thank you to Pascal Thomas, a good friend from 40 years now, who I wish was here, and maybe he will be later. I am a Californian. I have an intense patriotism to California. It's only one of the 50 states, but as you can see on the map, it's the place that pulls the United States of America to the left in many ways. And I grew up there. I arrived when I was 3, having been born in the same town as Ray Bradbury, Waukegan, Illinois, and like him, off to California with my parents. I spent most of my childhood and youth on the beaches in an agricultural community. If you've read Red Mars, you'll see all of the so-called French chapters in Provence with the character Michel are very much like California, because I've never been to Provence, but I have been to California. And then I've lived there most of my life, except for 2 years in Switzerland and 4 years in Washington, D.C. And I've spent an awful lot of time in the Sierra Nevada, the mountain range that is the spine of California, a wilderness area, a wildlife area. So even though it's intensely urbanized in the cities and against the coast, it has this area of deserts and of mountains that keeps it wild in a way, or connected to the natural world in a way that isn't very likely given how many people live there. And then, since Ugo mentioned the connection with Mars and the strange way that Mars serves as a mirror for our world, California is a terraformed space. In other words, it could only support a few million people in its natural state, mainly because of water and the lack of water. So it's always been a terraformed space in that a plumbing system has been built that is so extensive that until you see the maps of canals and pipelines for water, you can't understand the place. There's 35 million people in California now, and it's a space about the size of France, and so it isn't like it's intensely crowded like other places on Earth, but it's maybe 6 or 7 times more people than there is water to support until you bring the water in from the Colorado River, from the Sierra Nevada, from the north. And most of the water in California is in the north half of the state, and it has to be brought to the south half of the state. So when you think about imagining a dry planet being turned wet, I've actually seen it. And that, I think, has been helpful. People ask me, essentially, why? Why Mars? Why science fiction? I say because if you grew up in California, when I grew up in California, you become a science fiction writer in order to have a fidelity to the real. It's a form of realism. And the ordinary realism, especially literary realism, is not real. It's contained within a bubble that's historical and social. It's only about a certain strata of society and a certain private lives rather than public lives. In other words, literary realism is a little bubble, and science fiction is a planetary literature that takes in more. So I went to the right genre. Now that we're all living in a science fiction novel together, which we are, that we co-write together, where there's artificial intelligence and incredible technological powers, then science fiction is the realism of our time. So even though I chose this genre 50 years ago, I chose the right one, and it's nice to see this. Even crowds like this, an Utopiale in general, is a validation of the choice for science fiction as the realism of our time.
Alors justement, puisqu'on parle de réalisme, ton rapport à, la, à l'écologie, qui est fondamentale et qui est historique dans, dans, ton, dans l'histoire de ton œuvre, et, c'est un rapport très charnel. J'en discutais avec Pascal Thomas, justement, qui me disait, en réalité, le rapport que tu as à l'écologie, c'est le rapport aussi de la randonnée, la découverte des paysages. Et d'une certaine façon, on pourrait dire qu'il y a une façon de, d'engager aussi tes lecteurs à jardiner le monde, à faire l'expérience direct de la terre, avoir les pieds et les mains dans la terre. Et ça, on le voit bien aussi dans la trilogie martienne, on le voit bien dans tes œuvres, on le voit bien aussi dans la trilogie climatique et notamment dans le ministère du futur. Est-ce que ce rapport charnel, ce rapport physique à l'écologie, est-ce que ce n'est pas finalement la meilleure manière de parler de notre futur proche et des enjeux écologiques de notre futur proche? Est-ce qu'il y a en toi cette complémentarité entre le rapport physique à la nature et toutes les connaissances scientifiques que tu aimes diffuser dans tes ouvrages, toutes ces connaissances qui permettent de comprendre les mécanismes du climat, les mécanismes du dérèglement climatique. Est-ce que cette partie charnelle, cette partie vraiment physique, sans dimension intellectuelle, juste le simple fait de cheminer dans le monde, est-ce que ça reste très important aujourd'hui pour toi?
Yes, it definitely is. And I want to say I've just spent the last week crisscrossing France, and it's important to bring this question, the answer to this question to you. I do keep a garden. This is something you can do if you're prosperous enough and if you make the choice. It's a sign of a bourgeois existence. And as such, I'm privileged. I get to keep a garden. And it's funny that it's Voltaire, the last line of Candide, rather ominous, keep a garden like you might need the food when the world collapses. This, I think, is one of Voltaire's messages. So when I wrote Ministry for the Future, there was a new movement started by the American ecologist E.O. Wilson, Edward Wilson. And he said, it's called half earth. Half of the earth should be left to the wild creatures. And at that point, it could heal itself. And if humanity confined itself to just 50% of the earth's surface, the world might repair ecologically as a biosphere. Well, I read this and I thought, ah, that's utopia. This is another utopia by a scientist, a biological scientist who understands that the natural world is our extended body and that we're not healthy unless the world is healthy. Also, simply because the world is like your feet or your hands, that can't have sick world and have healthy humans. So I thought, oh, what a beautiful utopian dream. It will never happen. Just 10 years later, the world has signed off on a treaty in Montreal, 30 by 30, 30% of the Earth's surface to be left to the wild creatures by the year 2030. Well, it's a big goal. In California, it's already a state program, official state program, with a bureaucrat whom I've met, Jennifer Norris, running it. She says California is at 24%, and by 2030, it will get to 30%. And I thought that's because of all the wilderness. But my French editor, Tom Clegg, who got my last five books into French for Bragelonne, for which I'm extremely grateful, he and his wife were driving us, my wife and I, around France this last week in order to see Vallon-Pont d'Arc and Lascaux and Pêche-Merle. Incredible. And there is a lot of wild land in France. Not just the Massif Central, but everywhere. So this 30 by 30, which all the nations signed off on in Montreal, is huge news. It's incredible news. It underreported in the press because it's not charismatic, it's not disaster, it's not one of the wars. It's one of those movements towards the good that gets taken for granted. And it's also just a promise. It's not an achievement. So maybe it's not as big as I thought it was. But I think it was big because France could be 30 by 30, for sure, and has already signed off on that. And the whole world is probably like that, that we can start to restore the world to health ecologically by paying attention to land use and making, they call it habitat corridors, for the wild creatures to move without getting killed on roads. And even, I mean, to speak of ecology just quickly, it's the same in the United States as it is in France. There's a problem with too many deer, too many wild boar, whatever. The predators are gone. There are too many deer. The deer have ticks. The ticks have Lyme disease. The humans get sick. Humans, to stay healthy, need wolves in the landscape, need top predators like mountain lions or pumas. Well, this is surprising news unless you're an ecologist, where you understand that the health of the whole system requires all of the members of the community to be healthy together. So it was quite a treat to have Tom and Colette drive us around France and to see that this too is a, despite its antiquity, I mean, Chauvet was 32,000 years old. That's almost impossible to understand as human history. But even a country as old as this still has a lot of wild land.
Et des jardins. Et quand tout à l'heure il citait Candide, c'est ce que c'était prévu évidemment. On pourrait aussi citer Thomas More dans l'Utopie, dans laquelle évidemment, eh bien, on va revenir sur l'Utopie bien sûr. Chacun cultive son jardin pour la totalité, pour la communauté. Et les utopiens changent de jardin tout le temps pour ne pas être coincés dans une sorte de propriété privée. Alors l'écologie, c'est un rapport charnel. Mais il y a aussi le rapport institutionnel, c'est-à-dire le rapport organisationnel dans le ministère du futur, qui pour moi est un chef-d'œuvre, indiscutablement. C'est vraiment, si j'osais dire, je dirais un aboutissement des thématiques autour de la transformation du monde et de la possibilité du futur, de ne pas fermer la porte, de ne pas rester sur l'idée d'un futur sombre, mais un futur réalisable, une utopie réalisable. Dans le ministère du futur, Stan, tu fais appel à tout le spectre des institutions, institutions sociales, institutions juridiques, institutions internationales, institutions économiques. Le système bancaire joue un rôle impressionnant dans le ministère du futur, sans vouloir trop dévoiler les choses. Et en fait, dans ce ministère, petit à petit, pas à pas, des changements s'opèrent et se réalisent. Alors moi, j'ai été très surpris de cette façon que tu as d'exploiter les interactions entre toutes les institutions. Et la question que j'ai envie de te poser, sans dévoiler évidemment l'aboutissement du ministère du futur, c'est cette interaction entre le système bancaire, entre le système économique, le système juridique, l'évolution même de nos concepts constitutionnels et autres, est-ce que cette solution peut se passer entièrement d'autres alternatives qu'on rencontre aussi dans le roman, qui seraient par exemple l'action violente, le terrorisme, des façons d'accélérer le changement, qui parfois sont des prises de conscience dont la brutalité semble nécessaire. La question vraiment que je voudrais explorer avec toi, c'est parviendra-t-on à changer le monde uniquement grâce à ces aspects structurels, à ces institutions, où le recours à la violence est-il d'une certaine façon aussi nécessaire ?
There will be violence because there's so much anger and suffering, and we see it now. It's impossible to deny. We're in terrible danger right now, and everybody knows it. I mean everybody, by way of one's own personal life and then everything that you hear from the rest of the world. But in 8 billion people on this planet is an artificial achievement. It's accomplished by an incredible collection of collaborations and altruistic actions, social reproduction, which is to say all of the work that people do that they don't get paid for to take care of young people and old people. The amount of altruism and cooperation necessary to keep 8 billion people alive and fed is almost beyond comprehension, and it gets taken for granted because it's hard to keep it going, and there's still a lot left undone. 2 billion of the 8 billion people are hungry and don't have clean water or toilets. So the world is poorly designed, and there's a lot of anger that is justifiable anger. But okay, it's only going to work through the systems of cooperation, therefore the laws. So the laws have to change, and they do change all the time. So the possibility is there for change and for success. And so as a utopian writer, I've had to change my definition of utopia. If we get through the 21st century without a mass extinction event and without a collapse of human civilization, that's our utopia from right now. That's a utopian result. The best case scenario that we can hope for right now is to squeak through this century without a collapse. And we need to work on that starting right now, and we are. So the tendency to despair, like things could never change, or the tendency to give up, like we're already doomed, the scientists tell us that isn't really true. It's a structure of feeling. It's an imaginary feeling of despair that, well, people in power don't care, and they're being bought by the fossil fuel industries. There is indeed wicked opposition to the necessary steps being taken, but most people would like to see their children inherit a healthy world. So the will is there, and the laws are there to be changed. So this is something to write about. This is a story to tell. Now, it's not often told, and this is one of the reasons my Ministry for the Future is being widely read. People are hungry for that story of a best-case scenario, of no magic, no superheroes, no survivalists, just the laws changing in a way that make things work and we squeak through and make a world that's more just, and justice is part of the whole survival thing, and then more sustainable over the long haul in the relationship with the biosphere. So this is, I've been writing utopian science fiction since I lived in Switzerland, where I first began Pacific Edge, one of the books up here, and always the definition changes, but the project remains the same. Can we make a world more just and sustainable over the long haul? The answer is yes, but not without incredible conflict because of the standing problems, the already existing injustice. And to get back to what you mentioned, the banks, money. Money is a political power relation. It's not a natural thing. It's decided what money is and who gets it by way of laws being passed. And the central banks, fiat money, the money that we trust, francs, euros, dollars, the US dollar, a kind of world benchmark money, that money is trusted by us when we exchange it for goods because of a system of mutual trust that is created in part by the nation-state system. So money can, in fact, and it always is, invented by nation-states who then give it out. Banks also invent it when they make a loan to somebody. So it can be directed to green causes. Money is an instrument of political power, and it can be righted at source by the central banks. As in World War II, it can be deliberately targeted by governments to be paid for the necessary things. John Maynard Keynes said this: anything that we have to do, we can afford to do. So we have to make a better relationship with the biosphere. We can afford it. It's just that we have to pass the laws that spend the money. So free market capitalism, neoliberal capitalism, saying that group decisions made by financiers and individuals choosing what they want and paying for what they want is not adequate to the problem. We actually need to pay for a sewage system that nobody really wants but has to have. the sewage being carbon dioxide released into the atmosphere. So in many ways, we have to go back to the Keynesianism of the 1930s and the Depression, World War II, what you called the Trente Glorieuses, the 30 years after the World War II, where things were going well because government controlled where money went first. And it was the neoliberal counter-revolution of Thatcher and Reagan, 1980 to 2020, the free market regime made more injustice and more destruction of the environment. We have to make that step back into taking control of the economy. So this is another utopian and yet possible procedure that can happen.
Bravo. Une utopie programmatique à la Kim Stanley Robinson, voilà ce qu'il est en train de vous offrir, c'est-à-dire pas simplement un outil critique, pas simplement une façon de pointer du doigt nos faiblesses et nos hypocrisies sur le réchauffement climatique et le problème auquel nous avons à faire face, mais un programme en train de se construire. C'est ça qu'il est en train de remettre au goût du jour, la façon dont l'utopie peut nous aider à voir des étapes et à programmer des étapes et à avancer peut-être par petits pas. Alors peut-être j'aimerais bien prendre quelques questions sur toute cette dimension-là, notamment du ministère du futur en particulier, qui est vraiment la grande actualité. C'est un livre incontournable pour ces utopiales. Est-ce qu'il y a des questions sur ce qui vient d'être présenté et sur justement les façons dont on peut sortir de cette espèce d'illusion dans laquelle nous sommes tombés de c'est irrécupérable, on ne pourra pas aller au-delà. Alors je vois quelqu'un qui lève la main déjà. Allez-y, je vous en prie, monsieur.
Hi. First, thank you for being here because I've been a fan of your books for 15 years. And you're the third author I'm currently reading or have been reading as a sustainability professional that says laws have to change. But we are fragmented. We're deeply fragmented between the far left, the far right, the center. No one has the same opinion. So how can we go together as a utopian towards that goal, towards those goals? Because to me, that's a key question I have right now. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thank you for that very difficult question. With a very mundane answer. It's just coalition building, and it's trying to assemble a working political majority. Now, in Europe, in parliamentary systems, that means that maybe you can vote. I mean, I don't know. I would vote for the Green Party, but I would want the Green Party to be in coalition with the center left, with the far left. And in France, I don't even know how to pronounce his name, Mélenchon. I would do what I could to make collaboration that takes a majority and becomes the majority government. In the United States, it merely means hoping that the Democratic Party can get more than 50%, sometimes 51%, sometimes 55%, occasionally 60%, and get that majority and push and simply steamroll the opposition in a legitimate political process, change the laws that way. So this is a little bit of a cliche or stating the obvious. You have to win the political battle, and every country has a different political landscape, and who you support and how is different in every country. And citizens of one country, they can't even understand their own country. But if you ask them to understand some other country, it's truly impossible. Like, I don't understand the United States, but I completely don't understand France or any other country. There's too much going on. So the other thing I can say, though, because so much of my the book ministry and so much of my talks recently have been about the macro scale, the world, nation states, the European Union, a crucial new invention in world history where nation states become member states and they give up a little sovereignty in order to have a bigger impact. And we all need to be in the European Union in the sense of a functioning supranational organization that actually has teeth to impose its laws. It's a crucial experiment in human history to get out of the nation-state system and sovereignty. But at the other end, I am a proud member of the board of directors of Village Homes California, population 700, 200 homes, a village designed on a European model, an American suburb that was designed in the 1970s to imitate home life in European villages in the Mediterranean and elsewhere in Europe. The designers traveled around Europe, looked at villages, tried to understand what was different about them, and then built one in West Davis, California. So I'm on the board of directors. The big project, can we return a preschool for infants and toddlers into our village to make it a better place? Well, this is a teeny task, but no matter where you live, there is some kind of teeny task that you can apply yourself to that means you can do something tangible where your actions and your votes matter, in that they're, you know, the politicians' votes rather than the citizens' votes. There are environmental organizations and political organizations at the micro level that you can join. It's very, very satisfying and very useful, and it might help in the building of the political consensus.
La faculté de délibérer, voilà ce qui est fondamental dans la citoyenneté, et ce qu'on retrouve dans beaucoup des œuvres de Sten. C'est cette idée qu'on peut toujours échanger et construire par la délibération, et c'est ce qu'on trouve notamment aussi dans la trilogie martienne. Alors le temps passe très 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 vite, donc je veux bien prendre une deuxième question sur la Terre, sur le ministère du futur, et ensuite on passe à Mars et à la trilogie martienne, dont j'ai quelques questions aussi incontournables. Oui, vas-y, je t'en prie. Peut-être le micro. Je ne sais pas où est le micro. Voilà, super. Merci, Sarah. Voilà, Sarah Doc.
I really like your utopia, but some, for me, something's missing. What you write about is the North. What about the South? What about how can we help the South to get clean water, to get food, to get jobs, to get homes? How can we do that?
Yeah. Well, thank you for that. Another very difficult question. And yet, it's not that hard. The global North, so we're using North-South to really refer to the rich countries and the poor countries, to refer to Europe and its colonialism of the rest of the world, joined by America and the rest of North and Canada, the colonial countries and what is now called post-colonial countries, but because of the power of the dollar and of the power of developed countries to control world history, the countries that are said to be post-colonial are still suffering under a kind of neo-colonial economic power that they have no resources to resist. And they are the first ones often to get hammered by climate change disasters. So the solution would be to acknowledge that, and I think that's happening. And then the Paris Agreement specifically calls out differentiated responsibilities that take account of this historical reality of the post-colonial moment. The developed countries are to pay more for climate repair and for the, how can you say it, the hardening of our infrastructure so that we can deal better with biosphere catastrophes of climate change. The developed countries are required to pay more than the developing countries. They are reneging on their promises. They're not paying their bills. They're not paying what they said they would. I was once told by a diplomat that the amount that the developed world has given to the developing world for climate change is less than New York City's sewage budget every year, $20 billion a year. It's calculated it needs to be more like, I mean, the figures are quite shocking. It should be something more like $200 billion a year, or even $2 trillion a year, every year for the next 20 years. This is where the central banks become important. I watched the diplomats at COP26, and the diplomats for the developed nations were like misers. They were incredibly stingy with money. Even though money is an artificial construct, and the governments could actually make up, and did make up, a $5 trillion during the pandemic to give out to make sure people got through the pandemic okay. That kind of money can be made up from scratch and given to the people who need it. And it isn't as if it comes out of their own bank account or their own miser's hoard. So there's something psychologically peculiar going on in the even the diplomats, the well-meaning diplomats of the developed nations are strangely miserly and stingy with money. And meanwhile, the diplomats for the developing nations are intense. They're polite, but they are intense because they are stressed, because they're talking about people starving. When I saw that differential, I realized that, well, what can we do? We have to spread this story. This story has to be better understood, that it isn't coming out of our pockets, like our savings account, to create money to support the developing world in dealing better with climate. The better we understand that story, the faster we enact it, the better off we'll be. So it's just a story to tell and laws to pass.
Ok, alors petit à petit, le temps passe très très vite, hélas. On va parler de la trilogie martienne, qui est un monument. Qui parmi vous oserait dire qu'il ne connaît pas la trilogie martienne de Kim Stanley Robinson? Vous connaissez tous les 100 premiers, Saxifrage, Russell, Anne Claiborne, Frank Chalmers, John Boone, tous ces personnages qui, à Underhill, vont forger le début de l'utopie martienne. C'est la Jupiter de ton imaginaire, Mars. C'est le cœur, le centre de gravité. Mais maintenant, ça fait quand même un certain temps. Et cet héritage martien, qui est extrêmement puissant, qui nous a appris à mieux comprendre la Terre, finalement, et à mieux comprendre la sociabilité que nous mettons en œuvre, quand nous pensons notamment à l'utopie. Quel regard, Stan, tu jettes aujourd'hui sur cette trilogie martienne, sur le rôle qu'elle a joué dans la construction non seulement de ton œuvre en tant qu'auteur, mais aussi de tes convictions en tant que passionné par l'écologie, par les enjeux climatiques? On a dit de toi que tu étais la réologue de la science-fiction, et aujourd'hui tu es au-delà de Mars. Est-ce que cette trilogie martienne aujourd'hui, est-ce que tu la ressens de la même manière qu'au moment où elle a été écrite? Est-ce qu'il y a des choses, est-ce que tu l'écrirais encore aujourd'hui de cette manière-là où tout serait changé?
Well, thank you for that. I do feel nostalgic about my Mars trilogy. I feel that it is a good novel, and being a novelist, I like that feeling. It has given me courage as I've gone on since those books to try almost anything, because whether the experiment went well or went poorly, I still had the Mars trilogy in my back pocket and I could rest on it, feeling like at least once I wrote a good novel. So, and it's always been a pleasure to me that the first hundreds psychologist was a Frenchman, Michel Duval, who came from Provence and realized when he got to Mars he had made a stupendous mistake, and that the place that he really loved was Provence, and he had left it for life in order to go to Mars, and it was a stupid thing to do. Well, this is a fundamental truth that Michel lived, that going to Mars would be like going to a teeny little budget hotel underground, like a prison, for the rest of your life. It's not a sane goal. And when I wrote the book, it was a combination of things. Mars had been given to us by the Viking missions, and it looked beautiful. It looks like the American Southwest, like New Mexico or something, or Namibia, or Atacama Desert, or the dry valleys of Antarctica. It looked kind of like the most austere parts of Earth, which I loved. In my personal travels, it even looked like the High Sierra. And then also, it would be a new society. The scientists would take over. I had been, well, I hadn't been, but in Antarctica, the scientific utopia that runs down there, there isn't even any money. The scientists do their work, they're all happy, they're running around like dogs. And I thought you could do that on Mars and then maybe the whole world would become that way. So it was a modeling exercise. It wasn't a plan that we should go to Mars. It was a way of talking about opportunities that we have here on Earth. So, okay, all good. And since then, we've learned things about Mars that mean that I could not write the book now. The surface of Mars, it turns out, is highly poisonous to human beings. We did not know that when I wrote the book. The perchlorates in the soil, these particular kind of salts, they use it to kill off your thyroid gland in like parts per billion. And in the sands of Mars, it's there in like parts per hundred. So Mars is literally poisonous to humans. So more than ever, it becomes a thought experiment, like in Einstein. It's just a thought experiment. What if we went someplace new and had a fresh start? Well, that's never going to happen, and therefore you get to ministry for the future. Since we're not going to get a fresh start, since we're stuck in this moment, we have to deal, and we have to deal from where we are now. So I'm glad I wrote that novel when I did. It was like 30 years ago at least. But at this point, I feel like it's almost a category error. Or let's put it this way. It's like a fantasy novel in that it's expressing a vision, or a utopian novel, and utopias are always somewhere else. So, okay, it's good on that level, but it's not important. Mars is not important, not right now, given where we are. Maybe in 500 years, we get into a good balance with Earth, we have a functioning civilization, we have equality, we have justice. We could go to Mars and maybe chisel away at it, and 20,000 years from now, we have an Arctic planet that you could live on. Nice, but it's not important now.
Je suis très heureux que tu dises que tu insistes souvent sur la complémentarité entre Mars, la trilogie martienne, et le ministère du futur, parce que je l'ai ressenti effectivement, cette idée que d'abord on explore l'utopie, alors peut-être comme une fantaisie, mais comme une utopie, c'est-à-dire quelque chose qui n'a pas vocation à se réaliser, mais qui nous donne les éléments scientifiques, les éléments sociaux, les éléments d'identification de ce que pourrait être un monde meilleur. Et en définitive, ces éléments-là, il faut les appliquer à la Terre, aux enjeux qu'on a aujourd'hui, et c'est ce que tu fais dans le ministère du futur. Je pense que le ministère du futur n'aurait pas pu être écrit à l'époque de la trilogie martienne, et il est le résultat de toutes tes expériences. On voit là, j'ai mis quelques-uns de tous les romans et de tous les textes que tu as écrits. Tu as parlé d'Antarctica tout à l'heure. On n'a pas cité, je voulais le citer, Lisière du Pacifique, effectivement. Et donc, je suis tout à fait heureux de cette idée d'évolution dans ta vision du rapport que tu as à l'utopie à travers la science-fiction et l'utopie réalisable. Est-ce qu'il y a des questions sur la trilogie martienne? Je suppose qu'il y en a, parce qu'elle a marqué énormément de gens. Donc, je vais donner la parole à ce monsieur qui est là, qui a levé la main, et à qui on va donner la parole. Voilà. Mars.
Bonjour,
de Robinson.
Merci. Il y a un concept très important dans la trilogie martienne, c'est l'aréophanie, inventée par le personnage d'Hiroko. C'est une sorte de philosophie mystique, une manière de se détacher de tout ce qui faisait de nous des êtres terrestres pour embrasser pleinement cette nouvelle existence sur une planète avec sa propre planétarité, sa propre logique. Est-ce que vous diriez qu'aujourd'hui, en fait, on a besoin d'une géophanie pour embrasser une nouvelle planétarité terrestre qu'on n'a pas encore embrassée ?
Well, yes, and thank you for that. And thank you not only to the translator helping me to understand here today, thank you, but also to my translators from English into French. I think Sylvie Denis is here, and the other translators, and my editor, Tom Clegg, who has been getting these books into French and overseeing the translations. Thank you to everyone. And here's a chance to thank Bruno Latour. He taught me how science works, and he taught all of us how science works, that it's not magic, that it isn't transhuman, that it's a construct of human beings cooperating together, and it creates something bigger than any of us could do individually by a way of a group effort, group organization. And late in his life, which unfortunately ended a little too early recently, Latour picked up this notion of Gaia. And Gaia comes from also James Lovelock, but I have a great story to tell as a novelist that James Lovelock, the, what would you call him, the systems scientist, he got the idea of using the name Gaia, this ancient Greek goddess, from William Golding, the author of Lord of the Flies, who was a neighbor of his, and in conversation said to Lovelock, you could always call it Gaia, as being this ancient Greek goddess, rather minor in the pantheon, and also not entirely benign character, scary, needing to be appeased, sort of like the rest of the Greek gods and goddesses, a little crazy and arbitrary. But Gaia, as a... the Lovelock and Lynn Margulis, his close collaborator who helped to develop this theory, are saying that we wouldn't have an atmosphere without living creatures, that what exists on Earth is a totality that is somewhat like a superorganism, like we're all parts of a larger creature. It's not exactly true. It's all metaphor, including Gaia itself. But that all of us together, and especially life on Earth, kept the oceans from drying up, kept the atmosphere in the sky. It's been an ongoing relationship between the living things, mostly bacteria and archaea, but also all of the rest of the living creatures, all the way up to the mammals, have helped to keep the system going as a biosphere that's healthy for all of us. So, like, there was the moment of the great oxygenation, and all the previous life forms were basically being poisoned, and a lot of them died, but the rest of them adapted, and suddenly oxygen was a good thing rather than a bad. The story is the whole story of life on Earth, 4.5 billion years, is a story of ongoing cooperations between living creatures that are somewhat accidental or predatory or symbiotic, but in any case, they add up to a totality, which is life on Earth. And you could call it Gaia, and you can... this is where the indigenous understandings of the world come into play. And although we've learned an awful lot, this indigenous truth is still obtaining. The world is a sacred place, and life on Earth is a sacred collaboration. And so you can have mystical feelings, you can have religious feelings, and this is something that ever since the kind of the death of God, the Enlightenment, laicity, these various ways that we talk about this world that we're in, that have returned us really, all of this comes, so much of this comes from France, the Enlightenment and then existentialism. Okay, there is no God, the world is meaningless, it might even be absurd, therefore you have to make it up. It's your project to make up the meaning of life. Well, that's a little difficult. But if the life on Earth has been keeping the biosphere alive and all the creatures doing fairly well and evolving together, that itself is a kind of macro project you can believe in. So the Earth religion, Gaia, becomes scientifically supported if you need that, and existentially necessary. So it's a useful thing. The Areophany for Mars, can you have the same feeling about a planet that's just rock and poisons? Maybe so, yeah. And then it's a beautiful question for me because I just, was it 2 days ago, perhaps? I was in Peshmerga in a cave that had been marked by human beings to show that this is like the sacred womb of the earth where all life springs forth. This is a deep religious art. So art, religion, they become the same there. And it's 29,000 years old that humans were doing this, right in the middle of the Ice Age. Very profound. So to keep that feeling is I think, it's useful, it's meaningful, it's important.
Le lien avec la préhistoire, on le faisait ce matin avec Jeanne Debatte, justement, avec sa conférence qui parlait de ça, de l'évocation des premières traces, des premiers éléments, de poser la question de la mystique, du rapport à la vie, comme tu le dis très bien. Alors, on s'achemine vers la fin. Je voudrais qu'on passe à la dernière étape. Je sais que vous avez énormément de questions sur Mars. Je suis vraiment désolé de ne pas pouvoir vous permettre de les poser. Mais une dernière étape qui, pour moi, est très importante, qui est vraiment l'utopie au cœur du travail de Kim Stanley Robinson. Alors, pour qu'on ait encore le temps pour des questions derrière, je le montre maintenant. Voilà. Kim, enfin Stan, tu as un rapport à la Suisse qui est particulier. Pour toutes les personnes qui liront Le ministère du futur, vous allez vite vous en rendre compte. Il y a une réflexion sur la Suisse qui est particulière. La Suisse, peut-être comme une utopie ou comme une fausse utopie, enfin en tout cas avec des faux semblants de la structure même de la Suisse. Et grâce à Roland Lehoucq, président des Utopiales, voilà, je te présente, peut-être tu la connais déjà, la passerelle qui mène aux Utopies, qui date de 1991, qui est un projet architectural de Franck et Régula Meyer, qui sont des architectes, hein, et qui ont construit cette passerelle. Et tu vois, cette passerelle, elle va vers la mer, et elle va dans un ailleurs, on ne sait pas, elle va dans une projection. Et la question que je voudrais te poser, c'est depuis Mars la Rouge, depuis le début de ton parcours d'auteur, depuis le début de ce rapport que tu as à l'exigence de dissémination des connaissances scientifiques pour les lecteurs, et en même temps à ce rapport charnel à la nature, tu n'as jamais cessé de croire en l'utopie, l'utopie réalisable, de construire des chemins alternatifs. Aujourd'hui, à Nantes, en 2023, pour toi, quel est le meilleur chemin vers l'utopie ? Qu'est-ce qui va au-delà de cette passerelle ? Quelle est l'étape d'après, en somme, qui nous permettrait, peut-être pas de toucher à une utopie parfaite, mais en tout cas, d'arriver à ce monde meilleur, finalement, qu'on devrait être capable d'avoir ?
Well, let's call it history, human history. So Thomas More wrote Utopia, it was a peninsula, and the people who lived in this island peninsula, Utopia, they cut the Great Trench, like the lake here, so that the rest of humanity could not get to the Utopia and wreck it. And so utopian literature from Sir Thomas More, which we 500th anniversary of back in 2020 or 2015, for those 500 years, utopia has meant somewhere else that you can't get to. And so it's just a teaching device. But it's trying to teach us that there can be a better society, that we can arrange things better amongst human beings and with our planet. So the interesting project is to see if you could tell a story that gets you from our history to a better society. It's the Great Trench, and most utopian literature, even Le Guin's great The Dispossessed, it's on another planet. It's not here and now. So what I want to say is that we need to think about where we are right now and go in a good direction. And this is H.G. Wells, a progressive direction of history where things are getting better for humans, for animals, for the planet. That's a utopian history. And so the focus should be on history and how do we get from here to there. The good models, a better society, is pretty easy to imagine. Almost anything would do compared to now. But getting there is a wicked problem because we feel stuck. So the stories ought to be how we get the process started. So it would be very strange, but this bridge, I mean, it looks like a place to commit suicide or a diving board. But if you, like when we were in Nepal, all the bridges had been washed out by a giant flood. This was a climate change type event. An ice dam broke, a flood destroyed the valley, the bridges were gone. Immediately, people had to cantilever long poles of bamboo out over the raging stream, put stones on the end of them, and then build out again from there and get to the other side, do the same thing, meet out in the middle and lash it together. It's completely an improvisation. It's what I've been calling a bricolage, which is my name for Ministry for the Future, or any other mess where you're a do-it-yourself mess where you're trying to make things work. And that's the name for our history now. That's where we are. We need to not worry about the other side. It'll be good, but we can't imagine it. If it's better, it's better. But meanwhile, we just have to start building outwards from the suicide edge here in the picture.
Merci. Si les organisateurs me le permettent, on a encore une question. On a le temps pour une dernière question à Kim Stanley Robinson, qui reste avec nous, hein, qui n'est pas encore parti. Vous aurez l'occasion de le voir tout à l'heure en signature. Est-ce qu'il y a une dernière question, que ce soit sur la Terre, sur Mars, sur l'utopie, sur son œuvre en général? Est-ce que j'ai une question? Ah, oui. J'en avais une, évidemment, mais... J'avais 15 questions, j'en ai posé 3. C'est catastrophique. Allez-y. Le micro est derrière vous. Allez-y.
Thanks. So my question is about your writing, actually. I wonder how you feel about your characters, because when I read Mars a few years back now, each time I was facing one of your characters, the next chapter with another character criticizing them, and I had each time a new way of considering them, and I started like to hate every one of them because of one particular aspect of their personality. So I was wondering, how do you feel about them, and how did you write such characters in a way that we feel ambiguous toward them?
Well, thank you very much for that. I want to say that the method itself, where each chapter is seen from one character's point of view and their understanding of the world, and then the next chapter it's somebody else that is critical of the first character, you have to shift. This comes from Philip K. Dick. He does that in all of his novels, and it's one of the few things, one of the most important things for me, but it's one of the few things that it was applicable from Philip K. Dick's work to mine, because we're both Californians, we're both leftists, but Philip K. Dick is a brilliant, crazy visionary, and I'm not. So all I could take was some craft, which is an important aspect to writing novels, that craft of a characterization by way of multiple perspectives. Very important to me. And then, you know, as for my characters, I love them all. I feel alienated from them. I don't know where they come from. If I'm lucky with a character, I'm not there. The character's there. I'm surprised that anybody would say such things. If I'm not lucky, it's just like a puppet that does what it needs to in the plot. So the important thing for a novelist is to get out of the way and try to empty yourself. It's what Keats called negative capability, the ability to get out of the way, to negate yourself, and let the world speak through you, like a telephone operator. You plug in, this is from the 1940s, you plug in one wire, one character speaks, you pull it out, plug in another. Can you get out of the way? Can you be open to views that aren't your own and not have your thumb on the scales too heavily? Because ultimately, you are telling the story, and your thumb is on the scale. But can you, in the meantime, can you believe in these characters? So I think in the Mars trilogy, you're mostly talking about Maya, and then Maya and Nadia. Well, they're like sisters. They're highly critical of each other. It reminds me of Elena Ferrante and My Brilliant Friend, the two women in My Brilliant Friend, who back and forth, it helps. I think we read novels to have characters in a plot. So mostly I end up talking about politics. Well, it's somewhat of my topic, but I'm a novelist. And so if you like the characters and the plot is interesting, then I'm very happy, because that's really all I want. Thank you.
Bien. On va remercier Kim Stanley Robinson. Un grand applaudissement. L'auteur de monuments de la science-fiction, la trilogie martienne et maintenant le ministère du futur et beaucoup d'autres textes. Vous le retrouvez dans quelques minutes en signature à la librairie et j'espère qu'il pourra répondre à toutes les questions qu'on n'a pas pu lui poser. Thank you very much, Stan. Thank you.
ActuSF. Les podcasts.